You're listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North. In astronomy, this month of July has been the month of two things, comets and Mars. Comet Neowise, or to give it its full title, C2020F3 Neowise, has graced the skies of the Northern Hemisphere, becoming the first naked-eye comet for some time. Some have even argued it's the best comet for decades, and I think I agree. It was visible to the naked eye even from the street-lit skies of suburban Cardiff, and a delight to behold in binoculars. It's fading now as it moves away from the sun and will be back in about 6,000 years after a long, looping orbit that will take it 700 times further from the sun than the Earth is. If you missed it, then don't worry. I'm sure you won't have to wait that long, as there'll surely be another bright comet along at some point. They seem to come around once a decade or so, although they are rather hard to predict. In terms of new missions, then this summer marks the best window to launch missions to Mars. These windows come around roughly every 2 years or so, since that's how long it takes for the Earth to line up with Mars's position around its orbit. They'll be at their closest in October this year, and the way orbital trajectories work, a spacecraft launched a few months ahead of that closest approach takes just 7 or 8 months to reach the red planet. This launch window, no fewer than 3 countries are taking advantage of the opportunity. As I record this, NASA are due to launch their Perseverance rover in a few days. Similar in design to the Curiosity rover, which is about to mark its 8th anniversary on the planet, Perseverance will carry the first helicopter to fly on Mars. Named Ingenuity and weighing in at just under 2 kilograms, it'll make a series of short flights, taking advantage of Mars's thin atmosphere and the low gravity. From the other side of the Earth, China have launched their latest attempt to reach Mars. After a failed attempt piggybacking on a Russian launcher in 2011, Tianwen-1 launched on a Chinese Long March 5 rocket on 23rd of July. It carries with it a solar-powered rover that will parachute down and then bounce onto the surface surrounded by airbags. It's not dissimilar in size and landing method from NASA's Spirit and Opportunity rovers, which landed in the 2000s, but will in principle have technology 20 years newer on board. Like Spirit and Opportunity, it's also due to last 90 sols, or Martian days, and since Opportunity outlasted that lifespan by a factor of around 50, this might be the true test of the longevity of Chinese versus American electronics. The aims of the Tianwen-1 mission are to map the surface and look for biosignatures, signs of life, with the rover. But the real newcomer to the Mars scene is the United Arab Emirates. Their spacecraft, named Al Amal, meaning hope, launched on the 19th of July from Japan. It was built in collaboration with a number of US institutions and launched on a Japanese launch vehicle, so an international endeavour, but firmly led by the UAE. They had to skip a few tests to ship to the launch site as the coronavirus pandemic hit, but fingers crossed all will be okay. If successful, the mission, which aims to study the Martian atmosphere, will make the UAE the 5th country or organisation to successfully launch a spacecraft to Mars. We'll hear more about those missions to Mars over the coming months. But let's move now to spacecraft going instead of to the red planet, to the sun. Well, not quite to the sun, that would be foolish, but studying the sun from much closer than we can here on Earth. Back in February this year, the European Space Agency launched a solar orbiter mission to study our star and try to answer some of the remaining mysteries. With the first set of initial images and results out, I thought it was about time to catch up with the mission. I spoke to Professor Lucy Green from the Mullard Space Science Laboratory to get an update.
So Solar Orbiter is an ambitious and audacious mission to get up close to the sun. And what we want to do with the spacecraft is study the origins and the evolution of something we call the heliosphere. So my sort of way of viewing the solar system doesn't really focus on the planets and asteroids and comets orbiting around the sun, but it focuses on the extent of the sun's atmosphere. And the sun has this atmosphere that actually flows out into the solar system, creating this huge bubble in space that is, you know, tens of billions of kilometers from the sun to the edge. And we call this big bubble of gas created by the sun's outflowing atmosphere, the heliosphere. And the heliosphere is variable, it changes over time. And actually, by getting up close to the sun, we can study the origins of the heliosphere and understand how and why it changes. And that's what Solar Orbiter is all about.
So the Earth is, you think of the Earth not as orbiting the sun so much, or it is orbiting the sun, but within the sun's atmosphere. That's an interesting take. And it is the fact that we're within the sun's atmosphere, within that heliosphere, is really important for us here on Earth as well, isn't it?
It is. It really is. So I had this massive mindset shift when I started in solar physics, because I used to think of the Earth as being this kind of isolated object in the vacuum of the solar system. But by studying the sun, I came to understand that actually, no, it's in the atmosphere of the sun. So, you know, we're here on the surface of the Earth. We've got the Earth's atmosphere above us, and we've also got our own magnetic shield as well. But all of that is embedded in this very variable and gusty atmosphere of the sun that reaches out into the solar system. So I sort of now see ourselves as being intimately linked to the sun because of this. And so being in this variable and gusty atmosphere then impacts us. And it's actually the origin of what we call space weather. So, you know, we have weather in the atmosphere of the Earth, and we have space weather in the atmosphere of our sun. So it's space weather processes that drive things like the northern and southern lights, the aurora, and a whole host of other sort of impacts on our Earth system because of living in the atmosphere of the sun.
It's certainly certainly very noticeable if you live in the right places of the Earth. It's on my bucket list still is to go and see the northern lights at some point. I've still never managed to go in to see them, but I do certainly want to try.
Well, yeah, my top tip for that then is to keep an eye on solar activity so that you can try and get a handle on how likely you are to see them and how good the display is going to be. So people who are wanting to see the aurora should look at the space weather forecasts that are issued, and you can find them online.
Good advice. So Solar Orbiter is going to try and unpick the origins of space weather and the way the sun behaves. You also mentioned it's getting up close and personal with the sun. How close? The sun is pretty hot, so you don't want to get too close. How close is it getting?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really good point. So we aim to get to around 42 million kilometres from the sun. So to put that into perspective, there's 150 million kilometres from the sun to us. So that's just over one quarter of the sun-Earth distance. And then if you think, you know, that the scaling law is that if we get one quarter of the distance, the energy, the heat that we get goes up by 16 times. So it's a real engineering challenge to get images from telescopes that operate that close to the sun. And Solar Orbiter has been equipped with a very substantial heat shield that will protect the instruments on board. And then to give you a sort of flavour, that heat shield will heat up to around 500 degrees Celsius when it's at closest approach to the sun. And obviously that's a temperature that we can't possibly have our instruments operating at. So they will operate at more like room temperature, hidden behind that heat shield, and there are little holes in the heat shield through which the telescopes can peek, and then other instruments are kind of, you know, behind that as well, and maybe sort of peeking around the side to be able to make their measurements of what's flowing over the spacecraft that's coming from the sun.
So it's an exercise in cooling, basically, right? And cooling out in space is harder than cooling on it. If my computer were, well, I'm on a laptop, so it's hard to get to the inside, but if I had a desktop computer that was overheating, I'd install a fan or maybe a water cooling system and so on. It's a bit more difficult in space, isn't it?
It really is. So you have to radiate. You have to radiate heat sort of into the cold, towards the coldness of space. Because the really interesting thing is you've got, you know, the hot sun on one side of the spacecraft, and then you've got, you know, the coldness of space on the other side. So you've got this huge temperature difference, which is challenging for the spacecraft, but you sort of want to dump your heat then away from, out of the spacecraft towards the coldness of space. And the heat shield itself is really interesting because it's coated with a material that allows and enables that to happen. So the material has to be able to, you know, allow us to control how the heat moves so we can chuck it away from the spacecraft. It has to not get electrically charged whilst it's immersed in the heliosphere, which is essentially made of electrically charged particles. And it's got to have a coating on it that won't, you know, degrade over the many years of the mission. And the company is an Irish company called Embio who came up with the coating, and they realized that they needed to use charcoaled cow bones. So this very black, dark surface made from this very unusual material is actually what the heat shield of Solar Orbiter is coated with. And that allows, you know, all these sort of properties that are needed to make sure that this heat shield functions well over many years.
I can see the label on the side now. Solar orbiter, not suitable for vegetarians.
I know, that's right. That's right. There's a kind of nice thing in my mind, though, about like a cow literally jumping over the moon during the launch. But, you know, maybe a bit far-fetched.
So it's got all these instruments on board that are staring at the sun from a fairly close distance, certainly compared with here on Earth. What kind of things is it going to look at? Is it just taking, you know, higher resolution pictures from being closer, or is it more than that?
It's definitely more than that. And I think one of the key things is that Solar Orbiter is about getting up close. So we won't have, you know, fantastically high resolution. I mean, they will be high resolution, but because we can build very large telescopes on the Earth, they're the ones that give us very, very, very high resolution images of the sun. Solar Orbiter is about having a set of instruments on board that on the one hand take images from close up, which are in high resolution, but also have a sort of complementary suite of instruments on board that allows the spacecraft to measure the magnetic fields emanating from the sun, coming in the solar wind, which is forming the heliosphere, measure the particles that are in that solar wind. So what we really want to do is to be able to understand the origins of the heliosphere, look at where the origins are, you know, as in coming from the sun, and then measure what the emissions are like when they wash over the spacecraft, so that we can understand, you know, so one example would be the formation of the solar wind, which is what carries the material of the sun out to form the heliosphere. So we know the solar wind exists because the sun is hot, it has a high thermal pressure, and at some height the sun's gravity can't hold on to that gas. But we don't really know exactly why the solar wind is moving as fast as it actually does. So we want to get into that gas and see what's the heating in there, what are the physical processes are causing the gas to heat up, and we can look at ultimately where the gas came from in the atmosphere of the sun. So it's this lovely connection science. Solar orbit is all about connection, having this suite of 10 telescopes and instruments on board that allow us to look at the sun and make studies and connect it to directly to what's being measured by the spacecraft itself.
You mentioned that there's weather here that we see, space weather that we see on Earth. And I guess is one analogy that springs to mind is that on Earth we have weather in the forms of clouds and lightning storms and hurricanes and so on. And in terms of space weather, we have other things coming from the sun which we can touch on. But in some sense, is this what we think of as the surface of the sun has something that's more like sort of, you know, ocean currents on it. It's more of a fluid than anything else. Is that a good analogy to think of the surface of the sun as this sort of not water, but this fluid layer that's moving in a more like a fluid than a surface, than a solid surface?
It is. And I think this is one of the really interesting aspects of the sun. When you look at an image of the sun, so say an image of the sun's surface, it looks like a perfect sphere. But actually, that's just because the light that's being given off in that region is coming from quite a narrow layer. So it sort of gives you this false impression of the sun being almost solid. You know, it looks so perfect. But you're right, actually, in the surface, well, indeed, all through the sun, the sun is a fluid. And you're right, the sun has these swirling currents of gas motions, which are important in how the sun's activity varies over time, which is then a key component of space weather. So what we want to do with Solar Orbiter is to be able to track these fluid flows, these gas flows, and see how the material is moving over time. And in fact, one of the really, really interesting aspects is that we can't forget magnetism in all of this. And because the sun is made of an electrically charged gas, a plasma, the sun's magnetic field and the plasma are sort of tied together. So when you have these big currents of gas flows, it's actually evolving the magnetic field of the sun at the same time. And with Solar Orbiter, we want to be able to see how these things couple together and what the impact is on the sun's magnetic field, because it's ultimately that magnetic field that is able to power very large explosions and eruptions that take place in the atmosphere of the sun that ultimately cause stormy space weather at the Earth. So there's so many things sort of coupled into this. And then perhaps sort of one more thought around that is that Solar Orbiter will be moving in an orbit eventually that will allow us to see the poles of the sun. And that's a big unobserved, I'm not sure if that's quite the right phrase, but badly or not currently observed region of the sun, because all our telescopes are sort of in the plane of the planets. And with solar orbiter, for the first time, we'll be able to look at the poles of the sun and see how these gas flows are evolving and what that means for the magnetic field of the sun.
I guess the magnetic field is, if I think back to high school experiments or things we might do with students who visit universities, you can imagine a bar magnet with iron filings around it or whatever. And as you move the bar magnet, then the iron filings all shift around, except in the case of the sun, the change in magnetic field also shifts the interior of the bar magnet around at the same time. And that's the kind of thing that makes it complicated. So that's that sort of feedback. And is it that kind of thing that gives rise to these really explosive events, this kind of feedback and everything not resonating, but everything feeding back into itself and powering out? Is that a good analogy, or is that broken?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. It's so complex. And I love the fact that the sun's magnetic field is evolving on timescales that we wouldn't necessarily appreciate. Even our highest time cadence images show the sun's magnetic field on small scales changing over, minutes. But the way I think about the magnetic field is that it's a bit like a battery. So it's able to store magnetic energy that can then be converted into other forms of energy. And when you have all these fluid flows that are moving the magnetic field around, I sort of visualize the magnetic fields as being like elastic bands that are getting stretched and twisted and distorted. And those, or maybe like a spring being compressed. And at some point that energy is released into other forms and converted into other forms. So heating of the gas, acceleration of particles, and so on. And one of the key aims of solar orbiter is to understand, well, why does that energy conversion process happen? What triggers it? What takes the magnetic field from being in a state where it's got all this stored energy, and then suddenly, and sort of, spontaneously, it's able to convert it into other forms? And that's, we have some idea about what's happening, but there's still an awful lot more that we want to learn.
You also mentioned seeing the poles of the sun, and that's the reason that's been difficult is essentially a rocket science problem, right? That sending a rocket away from the Earth to get into the sun is hard enough, and we can come onto that in a second. But sending it up or down so it can see the poles of the sun is really hard. And the only time, as far as I'm aware, correct me if I'm wrong, the only time we've done that at all to even measure the poles of the sun is with Ulysses back in the 1990s, was that?
Yeah, that's right, Ulysses, yeah.
Yeah, so that did it by, actually, it went to the sun via Jupiter, which is a bit of a roundabout route. So it went out to Jupiter and used Jupiter to slingshot it into this orbit that sent it up relative to the plane of the solar system, or maybe down, doesn't matter which, and to send it into the big looping orbit. And I think it passed by the sun once every 10 years or something for a couple of orbits before the mission ended. Now, solar orbiter hasn't gone to Jupiter. It's gone the way you might expect. It's heading inwards, but it's still a pretty convoluted journey to get in there. So how does solar orbiter get to the sun?
So it's using the same sort of principles as Ulysses did. But because we want to get tight into the sun, you're right, we've got to go into the solar system. Ulysses made these very large loops around the sun, and Ulysses didn't have cameras on board to look at the sun itself. It just measured the escaping atmosphere of the sun in the solar wind. So it was measuring the components of the heliosphere rather than looking at where they came from. So for solar orbiter, we want to get up close. And that means we're using Venus, flybys of Venus, to be able to shift the orbit out of the plane of the ecliptic. And in fact, it's kind of the flybys of Venus and of the Earth itself are used also to evolve the orbit so that we can get in close to the sun. So we've got Venus flyby coming up at the end of this year, and then we've got a sort of couple more. But then by the time we're getting into the year 2025, solar orbiter will have started then to have its inclination lifted out of the plane of the ecliptic, out of the plane that the planet's in. So by 2025, it will be inclined at about 20 degrees. And then by 2030, it will be at about 30 degrees. So that just sort of gives you a sense that it's not, it's not a huge value, but it's enough to be able to peek over the poles. Compared to Ulysses that flew directly over the poles, we're not doing that, but we just we're able to have this orbit using the energy of Venus in orbit around the sun, sort of stealing that energy to evolve our orbit and just get enough of a view.
Another similar analogy to this, or another mission that's done something similar, I guess, is the Juno mission that's gone out to Jupiter, right? So we're switching astronomical bodies entirely, but that flew out and used one of Jupiter's moons, probably Ganymede because it's the biggest, I forget which, to send it into this orbit that looped around Jupiter. And the images we've had of Jupiter's poles were like nothing we'd ever imagined. Jupiter has a similar problem to the sun that we can't see its poles from the Earth because it's edge on to us, side on to us at all times. And no spacecraft has looped up or down to see it. But Jupiter's poles just blew everyone's mind with these storms in its atmosphere that made like pentagon patterns of storms and octagon patterns of storms and so on. I mean, are we thinking that we'll see something like that from the sun? Or we might, I guess we don't know, obviously we haven't done it yet. Is there any thought on what we might see?
That's a really good point. And I mean, those images are so stunning of the poles of Jupiter and unexpected. I think because I'm so focused on the magnetic fields, I've been thinking more along the lines of what happens to the magnetic fields by these fluid flows. So I don't know whether there's an expectation of finding a particular, you know, ring pattern in whatever, whether it's eight-sided or six-sided or whatever. I don't know that that's what we're expecting, but what we're hoping to be able to do is follow small magnetic fields that have sort of come up across the sun, so from lower latitudes up to the polar regions, and we want to see what happens to them. How do they sort of move? Where do they accumulate? Do they decay over time? What's happening with them? And that's related to the fact that as part of this cycle that the sun goes through, and the cycle that the magnetic field of the sun goes through, part of that is that roughly every 11 years, the magnetic pole of the sun's poles reverses. So what was a north pole becomes a south pole, magnetically speaking, and what was a south pole becomes a north pole. And we think that's about accumulation of sort of opposite polarity fields at the heliographic poles of the sun. So I'm much more thinking about what do the flows mean for the evolution of the sun's magnetic field, and then the consequences of that on the kind of global magnetic field of the sun, and what that bipolar field is like and how it changes over time.
So it's not the sun flipping on its axis every 11 years. That I think we'd have noticed that. It is this magnetic field. And so, I mean, on Earth, the magnetic field is kept stable with these magnetic poles, which I think is somewhere in Canada at the moment in the Northern Hemisphere. So slightly off from the axis of rotation. But that's generated by materials in the center of the Earth moving, by fluid, electrically charged materials moving in the outer core of the Earth. But in the sun, presumably there's these motions going on within the sun. How do we study the interior of the sun?
That's another area where solar orbital will help us. I mean, I feel like I'm saying, oh, solar orbital is going to answer all these questions, but it is such a versatile mission. So the technique that's used to study inside the sun is a technique called helioseismology. And that uses the fact that in the gas inside the sun, there are sound waves, and they sort of bounce around inside the sun. So the sun is sort of, you know, almost ringing like a bell that's been struck. And the really useful aspect of that for solar physics is that when the sound waves propagate through the sun, you know, they go through and then eventually they come up to the surface. And when they get there, they do what sound waves do. They make the gas expand and contract. That's what a sound wave is. And so at the surface, we can measure those expansions and contractions of the gas and then sort of work backwards to infer then what are the sound waves like that have reached the surface. And then to add into that, those sound waves, because they have propagated through the sun, they pick up information about what the sun's like on the inside. So what are the gases doing? How are the gases flowing? You know, characteristics of the gas. So this technique of helioseismology watches how the surface of the sun is oscillating up and down, and then does a huge amount of clever stuff with that data to work out what's happening inside the sun. So we can't see directly inside the sun, but we can infer using sound what's happening inside the sun. And Solar Orbiter will allow us to do that as well. I mean, actually, we have other instruments, telescopes on the Earth or on the ground, telescopes in space that allow us to do this too. But then with Solar Orbiter, because we won't necessarily be looking along the same perspective that the Earth is, you know, Solar Orbiter might be around the far side of the Sun. So we'll be able to see more of how the surface is moving and have more accurate information.
And that complementary approach to studying anything in science or in astronomy, but including the Sun, of course, is so important to be able to get multiple views at the same time or from multiple angles and so on. And as you said, there are telescopes on the Earth that are looking at the Sun all the time, and there are other satellites that are looking at the Sun. I mean, we have SOHO is the big another big European space agency mission that is 25 years old, yeah, this year?
Launched in 1995.
Wow. Yeah,
25 years old.
it's an ancient spacecraft in terms of spacecraft ages, still going strong. So we have a lot of spacecraft looking at the Sun. There's one that also launched relatively recently, which is also going closer to the Sun, and in fact it's even closer than Solar Orbiter. It's on a slightly different kind of mission, and that's the Parker Solar Probe. So that launched a little bit in advance of Solar Orbiter. What is Parker Solar Probe doing that's different from Solar Orbiter, and how will they complement each other?
So Parker Solar Probe, I think, has a very focused mission, and it kind of needs to, because it is going so close to the Sun. So I think it gets to within 10 million kilometres of the Sun, or maybe 7. I forgot the exact number. But if you remember, I said Solar Orbiter was getting to about 42 million. That's, you know, several times closer in again. So the heat shield on Parker Solar Probe at closest approach heats up to around 1,500 degrees Celsius. So much, much, much hotter. And that means that Parker Solar Probe isn't able to look at the Sun. It's just far too close. So its focused mission is on understanding the origins of this solar wind that blows out from the Sun. And getting in that close will mean that we should be in what we call the acceleration region of the solar wind. So again, it comes back to this question of understanding what's speeding up, what physical processes are accelerating the gases to the kind of speeds that we see. You know, and I'm talking of the order of several hundred kilometers a second. So Parker Solar Probe will do that, and it's named after Eugene Parker, who is an American astrophysicist who actually predicted the existence of the solar wind in the first place back there's about 60 years ago now. So he had a very nice paper that was out that looked at what are the consequences of a star having a very hot atmosphere that remains hot out to a large distance. And he realized that actually the star would not be able to hold on to that hot atmosphere. The gravitational pull of the star would not be able to hold on to it, and it must expand into space, must escape into space. So Parker Solar Probe then is named after Eugene Parker to get to study the solar wind.
So Parker Solar Probe is on its way, and I think it's done a couple of close flybys to the Sun already. As I say, is due to get much, much closer. Solar Orbiter is also on its way, so launched in February this year. It takes a little while to get to its final sort of science orbit, but there have been some results come out already from Solar Orbiter. What have we seen so far?
Yeah, so it's been amazing. I mean, it's so great to see the data come back. People have been working on Solar Orbiter for years. I mean, I remember writing my first sort of science case for what I wanted to do with the spacecraft back in 2005. And then we've got all these engineers across Europe who've been working on the 10 instruments. It's a huge, huge effort. And so these images that were released recently, they were taken from a distance of 77 million kilometers from the Sun. So about half of the Sun-Earth distance. And it was really just a kind of opportunity for everyone involved to see that all the instruments are working really well and that they're all operating as we want them to. But then even so, we still saw new things. And one of the sort of lovely aspects is to do with little explosions that happen in the atmosphere of the Sun. And it's kind of interesting for me because I study the biggest explosions in the atmosphere of the Sun. But getting up close, we've seen that actually these explosions take place on a whole range of size scales. And you know, there are a small number of large ones, but Solar Orbiter is showing us that there are many, many, many of the small ones. And so we're starting to think, well, what would be the collective impact of all these little explosions happening in the atmosphere of the sun? And how could that contribute to the sun having such a hot atmosphere in the first place, which is then ultimately the reason why we have the solar wind. So yeah, it was great to see the data coming through. You know, the data showed the surface of the sun, the magnetic field of the sun, the atmosphere of the sun, and it's just a kind of, I think it's a bit of a tease for what's to come. You know, the best is definitely going to be coming in the coming years, but it's really reassuring and exciting to see that everything's working so well.
It certainly is. What kind of timescale are we talking about for other results? So we said it launched in February this year, so it's that's what, 6 months-ish into its mission. That's a small fraction of the way. How long do we have to wait till we get these sort of the full set of results, or the full set of first results out of Solar Orbiter?
Yeah, so I think we've got a while before we'll get results from all of the telescopes. So at the moment, the spacecraft is in what's called the cruise phase. So there'll be lots of studies of the solar wind, but the cruise phase sort of takes Solar Orbiter closer to the sun. So we're going to have a couple of Venus flybys and Earth flyby. And then in early 2022, that's when we get to the a good close approach. And it's the sort of first close approach of what we're calling the main science phase. So in early 2022, the spacecraft will be about 48 million kilometers from the sun. And that's then when the whole suite of telescopes will be working together. Because we have to keep in mind that when you're so far away from the Earth, it's really hard to get data back. It takes a long time. So there's been lots of work around compressing the data, you know, making the spacecraft really efficient. But we can't operate all of the telescopes all of the time because we just wouldn't be able to get the data back to Earth. So the instruments that measure the solar wind, they have low data rates, so that's fine. They'll be collecting data, and then everything will come together in early 2022 for us to get our sort of first exciting observations.
Well, it's certainly amazing to see these initial images from Solar Orbiter, and very much looking forward to seeing the full set of results in the over the years as they come in. So, Professor Lucy Green from UCL, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this month. My thanks to Lucy and best wishes to the Solar Orbiter team for a smooth mission. And of course, good luck to the Perseverance, Tianwen 1 and Hope teams for their respective missions out to the Red Planet. More on them over the coming months. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk, and you can now even find us on Spotify. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.